Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Today, medical technology has advanced to a point that physicians in the past could only dream of. Doctors today have a vast array of tools, of medications, of techniques, of tests that they can apply to treating illness. And for that reason, certainly, we have the capability to treat things that we never could before and the potential for people to be healthier than they have been before. The fact of the matter is, though, that for all of the money that we spend on healthcare in this country, it seems that we're not any healthier. And in fact, it seems that at least we are told that there are other places where they spend less, where people are actually healthier. So what's going on here? This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a physician who makes the argument that, in fact, maybe part of the problem here is not so much that we're seeing an epidemic of disease, but that we're seeing an epidemic of diagnosis. At least that was the idea in a piece that he co-authored that appeared earlier this month in the New York Times that caught our eye. Our guest is Gilbert Welch. He's professor in the departments of medicine and community and family medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. He's co-director of the VA Outcomes Group in the Department of Veterans Affairs, White River Junction, Vermont. And his particular area of interest is indeed cancer and cancer screening. He's the author of a book that's titled, Should I Be Tested for Cancer? The subtitle, Maybe Not, and Here's Why. It's a book that's certainly available if you want to take a look at it. And the thing that caught our attention was this piece, as I say, this piece that appeared in the Times. Let me just read to you a little bit of what he and his co-authors wrote. Here's how it starts. For most Americans, the biggest health threat is not avian flu, West Nile, or mad cow disease. It's our healthcare system. You might think this is because doctors make mistakes, and parenthetically it says they do. But you can't be a victim of medical error if you're not in the system. The larger threat posed by American medicine is that more and more of us are being drawn into the system, not because of an epidemic of disease, but because of an epidemic of diagnosis. Americans live longer than ever, yet more of us are told we are sick. This morning in this part of the show, we'll explore some of the ideas that he lays out in this particular piece, and perhaps also talk specifically about cancer screening, and take whatever questions people have. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. At any point here, people would like to join in the conversation, they're certainly welcome to do that. Dr. Welch, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I know that this is a concern, the kind of concerns that you and your co-authors in this piece there was in the Times layout, that it's not something that is unique to the three of you. I know that there are many physicians that are concerned about this, thinking about it, talking about it, and asking the big question, well, what do we do? We'll try to touch on some of these things, and specifically, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about how these things apply to cancer. But just overall, the general point, maybe you can expand a little bit on this, these few lines I read from the beginning of this piece. What concerns you here?
Well, I think that the primary concern is that we've sort of moved into a mindset in this country that the road to health is to turn people into patients. And we're really asking questions whether that's really the best approach to pursue health in this society. And there are really two parts of this problem that we outline in the paper, but I'll review for you now. The first is our tendency now to medicalize everyday life, problems of everyday life that we all experience, some episodes of sleeplessness, maybe occasional sadness, problems with twitchy legs, all become diagnoses that are treated with medications. And this is not to say they're not people with severe forms of depression or restless leg syndrome or insomnia who wouldn't benefit from treatment. But all of a sudden, we're just expanding these diagnoses to include people with very mild forms of the disorder, and encouraging them to be on medications. And what this means is all of a sudden more and more people have become medicalized for things that in the past would have been just thought of sort of the ups and downs of everyday life. And it's particularly concerning in children. And largely with medications for asthma and allergy and psychiatric medications, where more and more of our kids are on drugs, on prescription drugs. And in fact, there was an article in the New York Times last summer documenting that as much as 40% of campers were on one or more prescription medications. And you have to say, what are we doing when we start moving to this degree of treating a large portion of the population? The second problem is our drive to find disease early. And I think we've all been taught that it's always better to find disease early than late. And the reality is that may not be true. And the problem is whenever we look for early forms of disease, we find a lot more than we ever knew existed before. There's just a lot of people who have early forms of disease, and some of those forms will never bother them in life. And the example that I'm most familiar with is in cancer testing, where we've developed this strategy to really look hard for early forms of cancer, and all of a sudden we recognize there's a lot more cancer out there than we ever realized. But it happens in other diseases as well. Osteoporosis, for example, so we look harder and change our definitions of what it means to have soft or brittle bones. All of a sudden we realize that almost everyone develops some degree of bone thinning as they get older. Same thing with high blood pressure, diabetes, etc. We're beginning to change what it means to have those diseases and include more and more people in the process.
I'd like to talk more about both of these things, but let's stick with the second point here first, and also to stay in the area that is your, for a moment here, that is your specific area, and that is cancer. Let me ask you about two kinds of testing, screening, that are common, that are recommended for women, and that we have been told have been good at reducing incidence of cancer. One of those is the mammogram, and the other is the pap smear. And it is recommended that women have them and have them regularly. And as I said, we're told that what we have done by having these kinds of testing is that we have picked up cancer, as you say, we have picked up cancers early when they are more easily treated and more treatable, and that the long-term consequences are that we have fewer women going on to develop more serious cancers that might take even more aggressive surgery and might, in fact, get to the point where they're so advanced that by the time we pick them up, there's really not very much we can do.
Well, let's stick with the example of breast cancer, because I think it does sort of show you the two sides of the problem. First, I just want to correct what you said is, we don't think mammograms lead to a lower incidence of cancer, that is, a lower number of new cases of cancer. In fact, we think it actually leads to more cancer. So the quickest way to get a diagnosis of breast cancer is to have a mammogram. What we think mammography does, and there's some debate about how much it does this, is it reduces the death rate from breast cancer. It is able to take a very few number of patients and help them live through their cancer who otherwise wouldn't. That's a good thing. That's a good thing. But at the same time, it finds more cancer. It leads to cancers being detected that would never be detected otherwise. And I know that's a very unusual idea. But in fact, there are cancers that meet the pathologic definition of cancer, that is, look like cancer under the microscope, but never would go on to bother the patient. And mammography finds those cancer, and so it leads to overtreatment. It leads some patients to be treated for cancer that would never bother them during their life. So there's a balance here, and there's this balance in all early detection. And the balance is that you may help some people avoid a bad outcome, but at the same time, you make others go through treatment that they otherwise would never need to receive.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me, and if I did say that having mammograms reduces cancer, you were certainly right to correct me, because that is, I certainly misspoke. Obviously,
right.
Mammograms don't prevent cancer.
They
but
don't.
As you
In fact,
say,
they lead more to be detected than would be otherwise. And that's the major downside of mammography.
Okay.
There's the downside of false positives And that is where women are made to worry and need to go undergo biopsies before they're told that they, in fact, do not have cancer. And that's more familiar to women. But they have this other aspect that is less familiar, and that is they lead cancers to be detected and treated that otherwise would never appear during the patient's lifetime.
Well,
it's a problem that, if I can just say, it's a problem that may be more familiar to your audience in the context of prostate cancer. And I think now this is a problem in prostate cancer where almost all doctors now agree, and a lot of the public now understands, that there are all sorts of prostate cancers that we can find that will never matter to men. And this problem of overdiagnosis in prostate cancer is beginning to be fairly widely accepted and widely recognized. And what I'm saying is, in fact, that is a general problem with cancer screening. It may happen more in some cancers than others, but that overdiagnosis is probably the rule when we look for cancers early, not the exception.
Well, let me ask a question that goes to how it is that the patient should think about their care and what doctors tell them. For example, I'm a guy and I go into for a physical, I'm 50 years old, my doctor will say, well, the recommendation at this point is that we start doing the PSA.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could either say, yeah, sure, whatever, and have them draw the blood.
Right.
Or I could say, well, you know, I'm only 50 years old. Maybe there's no history of prostate cancer in my family. I guess I just don't really think that's necessary. And it's possible that the doctor would say, well, okay, fine, that's up to you. So let us, though, then take a case of a woman who is at the point where it's recommended that she have periodic mammograms. She might also say, well, you know, there's no history of breast cancer in my family. And the doctor says, well, I really think that you should have a mammogram. And she says, well, I just don't think that's necessary. Now, and both of those patients walk out the door not electing not to get the test. Are both of them facing the same risk of having a serious undiagnosed problem? And how would you suggest people think about whether or not they're going to follow what is, at the moment, the generally recommended thing?
I think the thing people need to realize is that looking for early forms of disease is a two-edged sword. That there's likely to be some benefits and there's likely to be some harms. And that different people can choose differently based on how they want to balance those out. I should also say at the outset is that most people experience neither, right? I mean, you screen 1,000 women for breast cancer, 995 didn't need to even be participating, right? They weren't going to die from cancer anyway. So these things are sort of at the margin, you know, that for most people will experience neither outcome. So I don't want to overstate the importance of the decision. But I do think that everybody should realize that there are reasons that you might not want to be engaged in this process. And that is simply you'll be turned into a patient much earlier, and you may suffer from the harms of therapy unnecessarily. And I don't think that's something we have explained or shared widely with the general public.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Pap smear?
Well, I think the Pap smear, of course, is we are told is responsible for a dramatic decline in cervical cancer mortality, cancer of the cervix. I don't think we know that with the same certainty that everyone will say that it's truly responsible for this. And in fact, cervical cancer mortality has dropped dramatically, and let's be clear, that's a very good thing. And most people say, well, that's because we started screening for for cancer with Pap smears. However, I should say, you know, the only other cancer that has dropped at the same order of magnitude is stomach cancer, and we did nothing for that to happen. That was totally an environmental phenomenon. So it's possible for cancers to become much less common that has nothing to do with medical care. And the role of the Pap smear in declining cervical cancer mortality, I think, has probably been vastly overstated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I have a caller here I want to get on to, but I guess I'm at this point now feeling very confused, and I imagine people listening are too, because here what I'm hearing seems to go against, as you say, there may be coming to some point where we're going to refine the recommendations on the PSA. But at least when it comes to pap smears and mammograms, it seems that what you're saying sounds like it's going contrary to what every healthcare organization and the American College of OBGYN and the National Cancer Institute, and it seems to be sort of going contrary to everything else that we have been told and what has been recommended.
Well, I think a lot has changed, actually, in the last 10 years, and that people have begun to recognize that there's two sides to this story and that we really hadn't been sharing it. And more groups are concerned about the problems of overdiagnosis. I should tell you that the National Breast Cancer Coalition invited me to speak last year because they're very concerned about that. They know that mammography's led to a lot more lumpectomies, mastectomies, and radiation, and that there really are two sides to this problem. So I'm not sure I quite agree with your characterization that this is that I'm the lone voice here, because I think there are a lot of groups who do begin to recognize that there is a problem with overdiagnosis in this country, and that part of it stems from our, you know, sort of incessant efforts to try to diagnose disease.
Well, let's talk with the caller we have here in Urbana, and it's line number one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to relate a story about my mother. She was in her 80s when she had her first mammogram, and at that point in time, she had three lumps. The doctor that she had was recommending a radical mastectomy, but because of her ulcerative colitis, they wouldn't do any radiology treatment. My brother, who was taking care of her, freaked out, and she didn't want to do a biopsy and agree, you know, if it came back positive, to be put under the knife, and chose instead to go without treatment. Now, I had done a lot of research online and eventually convinced my brother that most breast cancers in older patients are rather slow growing, and the chances were that my mom would die of something else than breast cancer. I think that, you know, the side effects of a radical mastectomy in a woman who's 85 is, you know, highly likely to be of concern. And I said to my brother, do you want your mom to be a patient that you're driving around for therapy or because of a bad reaction? And he finally relented and decided not to force her to mutilate her body. I think that that women should be able to have the freedom to make choices, not to select the typical treatments for diseases. My mom died at 89 at home in her own bed, and she got what she wanted out of life. The other thing that concerns me about medication is that there are side effects, and I don't believe, from my personal experience, that the doctors are very cognizant of potential side effects and take that into consideration when they are, especially, you know, giving you different medicine for high blood pressure and cholesterol and osteoporosis and all this other stuff. And it ends up that drug companies are always coming out with a bunch of new drugs, and they want to get them on the market because that affects their bottom line. And they do the trials and submit them to the FDA, who then accepts their research and approves them. And there are medications that are approved based on 3-week trials. You understand what I'm saying? You don't find out till after the fact, like with Vioxx, that you're actually killing people. I think there has to be some sort of way to restructure the relationship between drug companies and doctors, because they are given samples of the new drugs and they use them, which encourages.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely think the doctor would agree with a lot of what you had to say. I'm going to give Dr. Welch a chance to comment.
Yeah, well, the caller makes a number of good points. And first, I want to come back. It's all about balance. This is not about throwing out the baby with the bathwater or rejecting all of Western medicine. If that was the message that people are considering that I'm communicating, that's not it at all. It's all about finding the balance of how much medical care to have. Let me just address a specific point she made so that I think everyone should know that she's absolutely right on. A lot of drugs do come out with fairly short-term follow-up data. And in fact, that most of the major side effects of drugs we don't learn about until after they've been approved by the FDA. That's absolutely right. And doctors probably are not quite as attentive to side effects as they should be. At the same time, I want to be clear the value of treatment for people who are acutely sick. And people who are acutely sick really do stand to gain a lot from therapy. What we're now talking about is expanding that to people who are mildly sick or minimally sick or, in fact, have no symptoms at all. And that's the place where I'm saying, yeah, patients really do have a choice, or the population has a choice. And part of that choice is to what extent do I want to become a patient while I'm feeling well. And that's the choice we're talking about right now.
I guess here again, there's two things in two ways we want to address this issue. One has to do with patients, and one has to do with physicians, obviously. So with patients, it sounds like what you're saying is that people need to perhaps ask more, at the very least, ask more questions about what treatments and tests are being proposed, and ask, do I really need this?
Right, and to recognize that there's an incredible push right now to make diagnoses and to start people on therapies, and that they ought to recognize those pressures and perhaps say, is that really something I want to be part of?
The other part of here is the various kinds of pressures that come to bear on physicians that promote doing tests.
Absolutely.
And making diagnoses that have to do, I suppose, the part of it has to do with people's expectations and the high likelihood that if there's a bad outcome, a physician might find himself or herself being sued.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of forces here to talk about that sort of foster an epidemic of diagnoses. One that you just alluded to is the idea that physicians are penalized for underdiagnosis, but there's no corresponding penalty for overdiagnosis, and that is something that is a very real phenomenon. Of course, that's not the only force going on. There's a lot of money around, and that money does influence what's going on. One of the most obvious sources of money is in the pharmaceutical industry, where there's a strong interest in expanding markets. There's only so many acutely sick people, but there's a large population of well people. So there's been a great interest to expand markets to include the well. And that's what I think is largely responsible for the medicalization of everyday life, and you're seeing sort of direct-to-consumer advertising, literally encouraging people to start various medications and to consider themselves as potential patients for one problem or another.
I want to thank the caller for her comments, and I have a couple of others I'm going to get right to. We're already at our midpoint here. For the benefit of anyone who has tuned in the last 10, 15 minutes, I do also want to reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Dr. Gilbert Welch. He's professor in the Departments of Medicine and Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. He is a general intern as to his research focuses on the problems created by efforts to detect disease early. He is the author of a book that's titled Should I Be Tested for Cancer? The subtitle is Maybe Not, and Here's Why. So if you're interested in reading the book, I'm sure that you can go out and find it in the bookstore or the library. It's published by the University of California Press. In addition, Dr. Welch is the co-director of the VA Outcomes Group in the Department of Veterans Affairs, White River Junction, Vermont, and he is joining us by telephone, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi, thanks. You are in this Outcomes Bureau of the Vets, so it seems to me that I'd like to hear this placed in a context of, you know, the whole healthcare system, the fact that, you know, we're not looking at what the outcomes are for statistically for what when the test is indicated. You know, if you have a gold-plated insurance package or HMO package, you can get these, and other people don't get them. So, I mean, I know we talk about that a lot, but I think in the context of who's getting tested and where the unnecessary tests and the preventative tests, et cetera. But there's always the other hand, and you say there is a matter of balance. When you mentioned the PSA test, the PSA test, as I understand it, is to establish a baseline so that one can watch that through time. And so it isn't indicated, you know, they're not just testing to be testing. They're saying we need to establish a regular regime every physical. You have a blood test, and we'll see if your PSA spikes or changes in one way or another, and then we'll know, we'll possibly know whether other tests or something is indicated. So I'm in the situation where my mother is survived colon cancer, as long as we're doing personal reflection here a little bit. I won't go on too long, but she has the regular CSA, but I'm urging her to get the ovarian specific antigen because she's been having stomach upset, and diverticulitis is the suggested problem, and there's some evidence of that, but that could easily be covering something like ovarian cancer. So I don't know how much more expense that's going to be, but, you know, I want my mother to be tested to see if there's something else going on. And I think everyone likes the idea of that. When do you say, you know, no, and whether it's policy? I mean, I know in Canada they don't do a test regularly that is done widely here because they have statistics, and they keep better statistics overall, I think. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, let me respond to a couple of things. First, your comments about the PSA are well taken. You're actually suggesting a more measured and prudent approach to the PSA that some doctors are taking now, which is it really isn't about the absolute level. We're looking for changes and how fast it changes, and I think that's a good approach, a better approach for using the test. It helps mitigate problems, but it doesn't deal with the fundamental problem that more men develop prostate cancer than will ever die from it. And you say we need good statistics, and we do need good statistics, but even when we have the best statistics, we have to be ready to deal with sort of apples and oranges. And I'll just give you a sense of the order of magnitude here, but you might screen 1,000 men, and you might benefit 2 of them in terms of helping them avoid a prostate cancer death. But at the same time, you may give 8 or so the diagnosis of prostate cancer unnecessarily and lead them to have surgery and surgeries that have some real downsides, problems with sexual function, problems with urination. Now, there's no matter how good we are getting that kind of statistic, we're still sort of faced with, you know, an apples and orange problem. You might be the two men that benefit a lot, or you might be one of the eight that suffers some harm. And the benefit may not equal the harm. The benefit may be avoiding a prostate cancer death, which is arguably, you know, more important than all the side effects of the surgery. But you still, and different people may weigh those things differently, but no amount of mathematics will solve this equation for you. It's fundamentally two different things. And all I'm trying to say is we need to communicate that tension to people, and people will have to make the decision themselves. Moving on to the ovarian cancer example that you mentioned, you suggest that everybody would want this. Well, I think that's not right. If they understood that this also would lead a lot of women to have to undergo operations to look for whether there's ovarian cancer, and some of them would also be treated unnecessarily. And again, it's this kind of fine balance that recognizes whenever we try to catch disease early, we end up catching other forms that ultimately would never matter to the patient, and it becomes a difficult balance to achieve. But I think one of my messages is that because it's a two-edged sword, it's not in our advantage to always be looking for more forms of disease, because the reality is, the harder we look at people, the more we'll find that there's something wrong with you.
Well, in the instance I offered about ovarian cancer and that particular screening, I'm not saying offer it in a blanket way. My mother has symptoms that I know of another person who was misdiagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Absolutely, and that's the other side of the coin.
Right. Well, I just wonder, you know, what you'd say about the other point I made, which is that we live in a country where the disparity in healthcare is so dramatic, and we're supposed to be hearing about it, and even the Republican president is going to apparently offer to tax people who have Cadillac insurance plans to help pay people that help subsidize the insurance industries to give it to the people that don't have much at all in the way of the healthcare insurance. So I think it's dumping money on the wrong end of the system, but that's another show as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, let's go on here. We'll go to, line number 3. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, thank you. And I missed your opening remarks, so if you already made this point, forgive me. But what I see is one of the fundamental problems with the approach of Western medicine, and which directly leads to the very problems, you know, you're addressing here, is that unlike, say, traditional Chinese medicine, Western medicine doesn't have any overarching theory of health. And so, you know, I mean, it's coming at, you know, the problems people have by, well, we're going to treat this organ, or we're going to, you know, put these pills in you for these symptoms, but they don't, you know, often really look at the whole person, their whole life, and how all these things fit together and, you know, what this whole person is and what it is to be healthy and how, you know, to maintain that kind of balance and health in your life.
I have not thought about this the way you're describing it much before, but I think you're probably right. To say that Western medicine, which, and everyone should know, I'm a conventionally trained Western physician, and I think there's a lot of good in Western medicine. Let's be clear about that. But I think the caller's probably right. We don't really have a good measure of health. We have good measures of disease. And we tend to focus on disease, and what we do is find disease. I think that works well for acutely ill patients. And if you're sick, I encourage you to see your doctor. I think what we're talking about in this hour here is we're talking about the question of what the well should do. And I think the caller is making the point that maybe if you're well, the system may not be for you. And that may well be right. that we're trying to sort out, you know, at what point should we contact this system? And that's a balance.
Well, as you probably know, an awful lot of the health problems people experience are because of their interactions with our healthcare system, that a great many diseases are caused and illnesses are caused by the way people, you know, get their health care and the pills that they're given, the kind of things that, you know, happen once they enter into that system.
Yes, you and I might debate on the magnitude of it, but there's no doubt that our treatments have side effects and lead to problems. And the calculus involved, I think, is fairly simple for someone who's severely ill, that the benefits in general tend to outweigh the risks. But that equation changes dramatically for people who are well.
Again, I want to thank the caller. Just a moment here, I want to go on to somebody else. I want to return to a point we talked a little bit about earlier. It was when I asked you to give your kind of summary of some of the ideas that was in this piece that you co-authored that was on the New York Times and the op-ed page back on the 2nd of January. You said that one of the things that concerns you is the medicalization of everyday life, the fact that common problems that perhaps everyone has an experience now, maybe they get some kind of name, they get a diagnosis, there's a potential of treating them with medication, and you see that as a problem. Just a moment ago, in response to what the caller said, you said here maybe one of the big questions that we're discussing here when it comes to the healthcare system is what the well should do.
Right.
Do you, this now here I'm making a roundabout way of getting to a question, do you think that perhaps it is the case that now if we do have this epidemic of diagnosis, that what happens is that rather than people thinking that basically everybody is reasonably healthy, maybe we have small problems, but basically we're healthy, we have gone from that to a point where we're starting to think more and more that basically everybody is sick, and that if you ask this question, what the well should do, the problem is there.
Audience of
people.
Zero.
Exactly.
Audience of zero. You know, this harkens back to one of the wonderful essays written about 15 years ago by Clifton Meador, which was entitled The Last Well Person, and it described a algebra professor at a small Midwestern university, and he was the last person that doctors hadn't been able to find anything wrong with. Yeah, I do think that. I think your point's well taken. And coming back to the caller's idea of, you know, we don't have a good conception of wellness, I should say that we end the editorial by suggesting, you know, perhaps the NIH ought to develop an outcome measure of, you know, who is well, and that ought to be our goal with the healthcare system, is to make that a big number. You know, right now we're tending to make the number of people with disease a big number, and maybe what we really should be focusing on is measures that say, you know, what proportion of the population are well and do not require treatment.
We have some other folks to talk with, and let's go on here to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question has to do with some guidance for how the patient makes these decisions. Do they want to have screening or not have screening? And for just a tiny bit of background, I will tell you I am a genetic counselor. I did cancer genetics for a number of years. So we would do risk assessment. You know, what's your risk to develop breast cancer? And I am wondering, and if an hereditary condition is diagnosed, then it's very clear that screening is indicated because the person has very high risk. But if I guess my where was I going with that?
Well, look, can I comment on that directly?
I guess the one additional thing I would like to say is. Do you see a role for family history in guiding patients to make decisions?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely, yes. And you're making a very basic point, which I make in my book. And when you're asking the question specifically about cancer testing, about how you want to proceed, one of the key things is to think of the characteristics of people who stand the most to benefit from cancer screening. And the answer to that question is pretty simple. Those at the highest risk of developing cancers. And you're from a genetic testing background, and obviously people who have the so-called breast cancer gene fall in that category. So, yes, it does matter what your family history is, and family history is more powerful in some cancers than others, but there's no doubt that people at higher risk stand more to benefit from screening. There's probably another domain that people should think about as they try to think about this whole question of, do I want to participate in looking for early forms of disease? And that's really to ask yourself, where you sit on a spectrum of that I might outline sort of at one pole of where you say, my interest is to minimize my contact with medical care while I'm well, or whether I'm on the other side where I want to maximize medical care in an effort to try to stay well. And I sort of characterize this as a one of two strategies, and I'm making them more extreme than necessarily they need to be. But is your main goal to sort of pursue health, or is it to pursue disease in an effort to avoid death? And there's sort of trade-offs on each side. If you minimize medical care, you might miss a small chance to reduce a bad outcome. If you try to pursue disease and maximize the amount of medical care, you face this rather larger chance of being medicalized and having a treatment that you didn't need. And I think different people fall in different places on this spectrum, and that's fine. I mean, this isn't about telling people to do one thing or another. It's about trying to give them a sense of the spectrum of choices they have out there and to recognize that it really is a decision that's up to them.
But it's the guidance and making that decision that I think throws people for a loop.
Yes.
How do I decide?
Yeah, and part of it is a matter of sort of getting a check of your own feelings, and part of it is sort of seeing the data relevant to the decision. And that's another thing we've been trying to work on, is to provide people good sense of data of what, 1,000 women undergoing mammography might expect, for example. So they have some sense of that balance sheet of the benefits and the harms.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. Gilbert Welch. He is a professor in the Departments of Medicine and Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Medical School. His interest is in doing research on the problems created by efforts to detect disease early, and he is the author of a book that specifically looks at testing for cancer, and the title of his book is Should I Be Tested for Cancer? The subtitle, Maybe Not, and Here's Why. It's published by the University of California Press. It was published in 2004, so if you're interested, you can go out and look for the book. And, of course, questions, comments, people can be involved in the conversation here. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have about 5-6 minutes left. Just very quickly, we talked a little earlier about some of the forces that come to bear on doctors that perhaps encourage them to do a lot of testing, and the concern about malpractice is one of those. Also contributing this, something that an earlier caller touched on here, and contributing maybe to the excess of diagnosis or the excess of treatment, has to do with the fact that we now have a lot of medications to treat things that we didn't before. Is part of this driven by the pharmaceutical industry? And I'm not necessarily wanted to demonize them. People will. That's not necessarily my intention. But right. if we have more medicines,
right.
and is it surprising that doctors will say, well, looks like we have a problem. Here we have some way to treat it. And here, take the pill.
Absolutely. Part of this story is about the pharmaceutical industry. And I don't want to demonize them either, because they've developed some good new drugs. But they've also developed a lot of Me Too drugs, or drugs that have sort of minimal effects, and yet the marketing efforts are incredibly powerful. Direct-to-consumer marketing has increased tenfold over the last decade, and everybody knows it. Everybody who picks up a magazine or watches TV can see the increased attention being given to market drugs directly to consumers, and they don't do this because they don't think it's very effective. They do it because they know it's very effective, and it has been effective. It's led a lot more people to be on drugs. Now, some people benefit. I want to be clear. It's not like this is all bad, but the people who benefit are those with the most severe symptoms. The people with mild symptoms, there the trade-offs are just much more close. And we've got to be clear that all of our treatments have some side effects, and as one of your earlier callers pointed out, when it comes to new drugs, many of those side effects aren't known till well after the drug's been approved.
Well, let's see if we can take at least one more call. We're getting short on time, though the caller will help us by being brief, and we'll go to Crystal Lake, line four. Hello.
Besides genetics, there's another factor perhaps in causing cancers, and that's if you've lived near in or worked in Rocky Mountain Flats, a lot of the men there develop testicular cancers or heredity problems from having worked in that area. And also, if you've had prior radiation, Dr. John Goffman says low dosages of radioactive particles is cumulative. Those cause cancers, and also if you lived under high tower, these electrical high towers, a lot of kids develop, I don't know if it's a lot, but some develop leukemias. And even soldiers that worked in Iraq where they handle, especially if you're near those handling the DUI, depleted uranium bullets, they develop cancers too and hand it on to their offspring. Radiation, if you live near a nuclear plant, I don't like to live near a nuclear plant radio reactor because they can cause cancers too. So how much does that figure in? Dr. Goffman claims that 3/4 of breast cancer in women is caused by prior radiation.
This is a slightly different subject, but I suppose we can ask the question, do we understand enough or do we underestimate the potential for environmental causes in various kinds of cancer?
There's no doubt that there are environmental causes of cancer. There's no question about that. I don't think they're as important as most of the general public has been led to believe, but there's no question that some of the examples that the caller has given are very real, and people who've worked very near radiation, there's no question this has an incredible impact on cancer rates. The question about power lines or stuff, I think, has been looked at pretty carefully. If it has much of an effect, it's pretty small. Environmental causes, except for a small group of people that really do have high rates of exposure, is actually probably a pretty small part of the story. Most common cancers are really sporadic. They're just sort of bad luck. There are some people that have very strong genetic histories. There are some people that have very strong environmental risk factors. By the way, the most obvious one is the one you hear so much about, and of course that's smoking.
Yeah. We're to a point here where we maybe have a minute or two left. I guess I want to come back to one of the criticisms that has been made of the healthcare system, and that is that we spend an awful lot of time treating disease, but we don't spend very much time on trying to educate people on how they can be more healthy. You know, we don't do much. We do a lot of illness. We don't do much wellness. But if we did more wellness, I suppose we could run up against the problem that we're talking about here, and that is if we're doing more kinds of testing and screening to try to assess people's risks for various conditions and then intervene. For example, if we can tell someone that they're at a risk for developing diabetes, and then we can tell them, now here's some things you can do in ways you can change your life that will reduce your risk, well, that seems to be a good thing. On the other hand, then what we're doing is we've now have a diagnosis of pre-diabetes.
Right. I think you're bringing up a very important tension. What does it mean if we have wellness promotion? And I think they're really two very separate things. One I advocate strongly for, the other I think is problematic. The first is health promotion, and health promotion is probably what your grandmother would have told you. It's about exercising well. It's about finding meaning in life. It's about having healthy relationships. It's about eating well. It's all the stuff that we know is important to help us feel well and have healthy bodies. And then there's this other part of wellness, which is really disease detection, and that's the part. that I have more problems with, which is sort of a medical model of wellness, which is the way to be well is for us to look hard for early forms of disease. And I'm just raising questions about whether that's really the right way to go.
And then finally, how would you suggest that people think about this, particularly now as they go about the relationship that they have with their doctors and what they do when they go into the doctor and what the doctor tells them, and particularly if they're at the point where they have to make a choice about, do I do something or do I not do something?
Well, I encourage them to engage their doctor in this discussion. I think more and more doctors recognize there are two sides to this story and feel that they're sort of caught in it, and that they just need to be doing all the early disease detection they can. And I think giving your doctor permission to explore this more carefully, some doctors will react quite well to. I mean, because they've had some questions themselves about the wisdom of some of the strategies we're following. So I encourage that discussion. Give your doctor permission not to look hard for disease.
Our guest this morning, Dr. Gilbert Welch, is professor in the Departments of Medicine and Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth Med School. He's interested in some of the problems created by efforts to detect disease early. His book is Should I Be Tested for Cancer? Maybe Not, and Here's Why, a book that was published in 2004, and it's published by the University of California Press. I'm sure people could find it if they're interested. Dr. Welch, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.